Subtitles, where we spike the canon in music and movies. In each episode, we will offer up replacements for each title in the top 100 of a well-known, well-regarded ranking, and we'll walk away with a pair of subtitles, which we think deserve more acclaim and to which attention must be paid. I'm Matt, and I'm replacing the top 100 entries on Spin Magazine's 2015 list of the top 300 albums from 1985 until 2015, starting with number 1 and working down.
And I'm Tim. I'm replacing the entries on the 2007 AFI 100 Years, 100 Movies list, starting with number 100 and working up.
Here's how this works. Two of us have gone through each list, decided on a theme of the original entry, and have come up with a pair of potential replacement titles which share that theme. We'll talk about that original entry. Sometimes we'll regret that we have to get rid of it, and sometimes we'll rejoice in being able to drop it. But this podcast is not just another dissection of an outmoded list. In part one of this episode, I have two new albums to talk through, and Tim will make the choice for the subtitles albums list. Then in part two, Tim will have two new movies to discuss, and I will decide which of them deserves a place on the subtitles movies list. Sometimes I'll have seen the movies, sometimes Tim will have listened to the albums, but at the end of the day, what matters is how well we've sold the titles. And at the end of some of those days, one of us will want to bop the other for that choice. Once we finish this off, we'll do some fun activities with the new lists we've collaborated on, but before we can get there, we have to do this. Today's title to be replaced is Janet Jackson's Rhythm Nation 1814 by, shocker, Tito Jackson. That's right. No, Janet Jackson, her 1989 album. The one right after, Control, which was 1986, and that has... that big song that I'm suddenly blanking on the name of. So that's embarrassing. Whatever. Tim, you had a chance to listen to this one, right?
Yes.
You seemed unimpressed. Talk to me.
I think my issue with it wasn't so much being unimpressed. It's, it was just, like, it does that thing that I'm kind of bored by, and it in that it, like, leads with sort of this platitudinous beginning, sort of, like, you know, the whole children are our future bit, which has never been my favorite version of lyrics, no matter who does them. So, like, a lot of the, I don't know, it seems maybe unfair to compare, some of the tracks off the first half of the album to, like, Black or White, just considering that you have to look outside the Jackson family eventually. But, like, they reminded me primarily of that, like, State of the World was just very much that same vibe, and I couldn't quite get into that. But then, like, the middle of this album was really exciting. Like, the middle and end of this album, I thought, was, like, way more interesting, just sort of letting the music go with a message that felt like it fit it better. I don't know. There was something about the basically pessimistic approach of the first half of the album that just does not feel very New Jack Swing to me. That there's just sort of like a lack of the lightheartedness that I feel like kind of just goes better with the sound.
You don't know how men make New Jack Swing in the 20th century, which oddly enough could have been the title for today, but that's long and doesn't fit well on the card. Nasty was the song I was blanking on and shouldn't have been blanking on. This album is here because of its music. I'm pretty confident in saying that. I don't know. Maybe some people think that's a hot take, but I don't think it's really here for its message. Though, credit to Jackson. Like, you don't often get a concept dance pop R&B fusion album. Like, there's a ton of happening here. And it is not often grafted to, like, the more dour, more serious message of the opening of the album in particular. And if you read about this one, it's right, Jackson. If you read about this one, Jackson sequenced it very deliberately. Yeah, it's amazing the ones I forget sometimes. So the beginning is supposed to be that I don't know, more socially conscious thing, you know, where she's looking at poverty, the crack epidemic at the time, youth violence. She's really focused on children here. And I agree with you. Like, when it gets sort of rotely platitudinous, I check out very quickly. I don't know what it is about this one. Like, I don't think it's great, but I think it's just kind of doofy, and that I find charming. Like, I don't know. I appreciate the attempt here, even if I listen to it and I'm like, yeah, whatever. Not that Jackson's like wrong about anything or like touching on bad stuff. Like it's very serious matter, but you're right. Like, it just doesn't quite fit with the music, but like I deeply appreciate the attempt here. And she's kind of talked about this and it is, and was honest about, like, look, I know it's not going to change the world, but if I can get someone, like, if I can get kids especially listening with this music, and maybe something happens, like, maybe there's some change, maybe, like, individually some people pick this up and hear it, and, like, that's big for them. And I appreciate that, like, a lot, that sort of cognizance of what she's doing, and how this album might be perceived, and, like, how the message is fitting the music. And I think she said elsewhere, like, you know, she was inspired by artists like Dylan, Joni Mitchell, U2, you know, if, whether you want to clown them or not, like, but they're big in 1989.
When they were doing that stuff.
Yeah, yeah, we talked about them in an earlier episode. Go listen to that. They were important. You know, artists like that, she's like, they all have great messages, but it feels geared towards adults who already care. And she's working in genres that are for a different kind of audience. So again, she's very cognizant here of, like, what if I can hit younger audiences with some sort of message or some sort of, you know, just realization of problems. Maybe something can happen. And so for that reason, like, I agree with you in general with this one. I'm sort of like, aw. Like, not in an infantilizing way, just like, I really appreciate that sense of, look, I know it's not going to change the world, but it's something. So I, you know, I can't, like, clown this album, just because of Jackson's awareness of, like, look, I know what I'm doing, and maybe it's kind of weird, but, like, it does have a purpose. Yeah, go ahead.
I mean, if nothing else, it's not cynical. There's nothing cynical. There's no, like, showboating about it in this. Like, I genuinely believe in the earnestness of the message, which, if to be very real, like, if I had not believed in the earnestness of the message, then I would have had a hard time getting through this one. But yeah, there's definitely no doubt that she's, like, you know, got good intentions. Like, these are, it is hard to make the lyrics seem profound over an issue that I think a lot of people, or over the several issues, I don't want to make it sound like she's only talking about one thing, but, like, over several issues that are important, it just sort of nice to hear someone who cares. And at the same time, this seems like such an odd, like, odd album musically to care like this. So no, it's not like, it was not a bad listening experience. This is not even a bottom 10, like, spin list album that we've listened to so far. Maybe I'm still riding a little bit off the PJ Harvey high of last week.
Top 10 spin album. when I get my druthers, I don't know, that's close. Top 20. My favorite moment on this album, absolutely, is the very end of State of the World, the get the point, good, let's dance. Phenomenal. So stupid and so perfect and so brilliant at the same time. Like, I love that moment. I love the delivery. It's what everyone is thinking, and Jackson just says it, and I appreciate that to no end. And that's essentially what is happening thematically across Janet Jackson's Rhythm Nation 1814. A lot of point setting, of more descriptive work than anything, of like, hey, here are the things. It's not polemical. It's more just honest and earnest. And then it wants to dance. And like, it wants to dance while it's being socially conscious. And hey, I can get down for that. But again, the music, I think, is more why this album is here, why it is on a bunch of lists, though I am very curious where it ends up in the next edition of this. I don't really know what the like ongoing sense of this album is critically. It's one I was familiar with, but not one I had really wrestled with before this list, to be honest. So like, I don't actually know what its like general standing is. I think it's very appreciated as a musical and production experience. So for those reasons, it can probably hang on in the back half, I would think. But I don't have a great sense of like, do I think this one will rise or fall or stay pretty much in the same spot? Yeah, go ahead.
I wonder if in the larger discourse, where I think many of us have had to reconsider our reaction to the strangely named Nipplegate, I kind of wonder if there is some. I mean, I know there is reevaluation of that moment for sure. Like, I've read the pieces about that. But I wonder if that will sort of carry over for whatever the next version of this spin list is. And, you know, just sort of thinking about Jackson's work as a musical artist again, and like trying to get into that, I wonder if that does not like even help preserve like this particular like tier of the list that it's in.
So that's the thing I've been wrestling with most. I think so. I want to emphasize I there, because, like, again, I don't see much on this right now, but I think that'll happen. I think, like, we're far enough away from that moment, which was stupid to begin with, that, right, like, Janet Jackson was a very talented artist who made a lot of good stuff, and got unjustly just run over and, like, forgotten pretty much for a while, so I think the ongoing reevaluation of that moment and just the like, hey, maybe we were too mean to Janet Jackson. We were. That may well help. That's not the only reason this album is on here. I don't want to make it seem that way, but I think, right, that helps make us more cognizant probably of like, oh yeah, she was up to some really interesting stuff. And like, this or Control, I wouldn't be surprised if that makes it somewhere, belong on these sorts of lists. I think it's well deserving. I think it is one of those ones that like, it's harder to hear how profound it was in 89 now. So we haven't had one of those in a minute, I don't think, so we'll talk about that a bit. But I think it's well deserving of where it is. Endlessly amused and delighted that this is here and no Michael Jackson album is. That makes me happy. I guess if you take anything away from this, we did Janet Jackson real dirty in the early 2000s, and we should still be unspooling the effects of that. And it's an enjoyable album if you just like listen to the message, get it, good. And then just kind of vibe out to this thing, because musically there is a lot of really cool stuff happening here. And as Tim invoked, this is New Jack Swing based, at least. It's doing a lot more. It's not as thoroughly New Jack Swing as Control was, but that's going to be our theme for today. We haven't had an explainer one, I don't think, in a while, so we're going to explain a genre that I am by no means an expert in, but here we go. So Rhythm Nation 1814, let's talk about the title first, because I forgot to do that. Any guesses why the 1814 is significant? Yeah, you have your hand up, you're excited.
Yes, because it's a way to honor the Treaty of Ghent, which ended the War of 1812, and it's an important time in our nation's history as a as a way to assert itself against European powers.
You're close.
No, I'm not.
There's are. It's the year the Star Spangled Banner was written.
I'm so mad at myself that that joke was not more jokey.
No, you're in the right war. Ha ha, loser.
I'm so pleased with myself.
Your historical knowledge ruins you again. Hoisted by your own petard. So yeah, it's 1814 because the parallel with Star Spangled Banner, Rhythm Nation, Janet Jackson imagining her own world of dance and rhythm and utopia, if you will. I'm so glad you got that close, but went with the Treaty of Ghent. Now I want the Janet Jackson album on the Treaty of Ghent. Anyway, moving forward, that's why the 1814 is here. I don't think literally Reddit, but Reddit, you know, esque activities discovered that the R and N are, I think, the 18th and 14th letter of the alphabet, which Jackson has responded to and said is completely coincidental, but man, it's funny as hell. Yeah.
That's some very strong numerology, because I'm like sitting here counting the alphabet. I'm like, they are those letters. No, I was going to say that if this were an album about the Treaty of Ghent, then we'd have to get into New Jacques Swain instead of New Jack Swain, probably.
You're also close to my segue in the future.
Unbelievable.
So, yeah, that's why we have the 1814, if you were wondering, why the hell is that year in here? That's why. So, what is Rhythm Nation up to? A lot of things. Again, New Jack Swing, based or adjacent, whatever you want to call it, it is pulling that out of control. But there's a lot more going on here. So, right across this album, you could call it a fusion or... just you know, kind of alternating between R&B, rap, funk, disco, synth music, like electronica. You know, there's some harder rock, heavy metal, like industrial stuff that kind of comes in. Like, there's a whole bunch of different elements happening in this thing that make it a super interesting sonic experience, but also are what make it really hard to sense, like, why this was important. Because it's another one, you know, we've talked about several albums like this. It's another one that, like, the DNA of this is just kind of what's in the water now. And in 89, that's definitely not the case. Like, this is bringing together a lot of stuff that wasn't really in conversation too much at the time. Rap and R&B especially, which is going to be important to one of our subtitles today in particular. They were not talking so much in 1989. They had, you know, maybe not necessarily diametrically opposed missions, but they were kind of up to very different things. Part of that is thematic, is lyrical, is why Jackson's kind of let's be socially conscious and dance can seem maybe ham-fisted at the same time that, like, in 89, kind of big thing. Like, those are two genres, like, R&B is more at the time, or the dance pop, which however you want to classify, you know, what these songs are doing, they're not being totally conscious. That's the stuff of hip hop, and hip hop's not being very lighthearted at this moment. So already we have Jackson kind of bringing all this stuff together and bringing a lot of different production technology in particular. This is an album that is a lot of digital instrumentation. I don't think there's much, if any, live performance on here besides vocals. But it's a lot of synth and digital creation, which is really impressive on its own. But that it's so wide-ranging then is... Right, that they're creating this all artificially as well. So it's an album, again, that's up to a lot of things that to us just sounds kind of, yeah, whatever at this point, because a lot of artists do this, but this is one of those ones that's like, no, this is big to actually making that the norm. So I think this is an album with a long shadow that also, you know, I think should help preserve its spot. That it's one of those ones we can go back to as like, maybe we don't hear it now, but man, it's a big kind of focal point or like a prism where everything, nearly everything that comes after is going to be doing a lot of stuff similar to this. And again, the production on here is just really good, really, really interesting throughout. So it's a very technically ambitious and fun album, which I don't think, you know, doesn't always get all the plaudits on lists like this, but I think it's worth noting. So that's kind of Rhythm Nation 1814 in a very broad view. What is New Jack Swing, though? Tim, what is New Jack Swing?
Pretty good. I'll go on. Like, my general impression, again, being even less of a scholar in this area than Matt is sort of this impression of music which has, like, hip-hop as a basis, but it's also, like, extremely rhythm-oriented, like, extremely, like, hard drum beat, especially, like, doing techier stuff, like, not actual instrumentation, but, like, the power of the drum machine is real. You have a lot of that. It's like if you took disco a little bit. This is one of the reasons I enjoy the New Jack Swing I actually listen to, is because, like, if you took disco and, like, genuinely kind of mashed it up with like, your mid-80s rap hip-hop scene, it feels like that's more or less the New Jack Swing vibe.
As always, Tim just wants more ABBA.
More disco!
Yeah, that's a pretty good working definition. You hit on most of the stuff. Yeah, the drum machine is huge, and the sound of the drums, the snare in particular, that, like, trash can snare, that's, to me, the easiest way to be like, okay, this is at least talking to New Jack Swing, if it's not, you know, literally it. There's a lot of, like, musicology stuff you could get into that I'm not going to right now, but there are, right, particular rhythms and kind of production tricks that go into New Jack Swing. Like, there's certain emphasis points on 16 beats. I'm not going to go into that, but right, there are, if this is something you want to dig into as a listener, if you're really interested in music theory, like, there's more here. But I'm just talking kind of general sound for, like, quick identification. So I think the drum machine and the sound of the snare in particular, and that, like, insistent kind of halting rhythm, it's very syncopated. That's important to it. But there is a swing to it, like, right, that's in the name. There's a swing, there's a syncopated rhythm, there's that kind of arresting snare, right? All of that, I think, is the easiest stuff to pick out. But what's also important is the, right, is the blend here. So it's that stuff, it's those, machine-produced backbeats, really. And then you're kind of layering over that much lighter melodies. Usually there's a pretty warm kind of bass line in there, you know, helping ground the rhythm. Very crisp vocals, usually. Some, like, doo-wop, nearly harmonies happening, right? There's much lighter stuff over top. There's much more R&B stuff happening over top. Over top, again, of these syncopated swung rhythms and the drums that can be very harsh. So, right, it's the combination of, or it's the fusing of R&B and hip-hop in the late 80s, early 90s in particular, where those two things are and kind of smashing them together. But Teddy Riley, who is big, like, he is the New Jack Swing guy. He described it very succinctly and very nicely as sweet melody with big beats. And I think that's a very good way of putting it. Again, it's this very crisp, clean, very pleasing melody and vocal harmonies over top of, pretty halting breakbeats. And those are being taken from hip-hop, from the sampling technology at the time. Again, altered a bit. The snare is very distinct, as I've said, but they're driving beats. You really hear those before you hear anything else. Yeah, I mean, all that's elaborating on basically what you said, Tim, but I think, we can have an operating definition of it's hip-hop and R&B blended together as they were understood in the late 80s, in particular when those two things weren't doing the same thing. They were not up to the same missions. Think of New Edition and Public Enemy. Maybe we can see them as representative of two different sides. They're up to very different things. So what happens when we kind of bring elements of both together? Again, Rhythm Nation 1814 is doing that and bringing in much more. But you can hear, especially early on, like I think those first few tracks, like you can hear the new jack swing of it all. The drums hit you immediately. There's very fun synth melodies across all of those. Jackson's voice is traditionally good, like classically good in terms of pop music anyway. So it is this, in 89 it would have been an experience. Like, okay, what do we do with all these things together? She's not rapping, but there's clearly rap in this DNA, but she's a singer. And like, there's clearly R&B here, but she's talking about something that we're not familiar with in art. Like, right, it's all of these things kind of coming to a head into this interesting blend. And that's a reason why this album is important, and it's a reason why New Jack Swing is really interesting. So we'll talk about two other defining albums of New Jack Swing. All of them are up to their own little unique things. Like, New Jack Swing is just a bass. But all of them are kind of experimenting in different ways. I don't want to make it seem like any of these are just purely one thing, especially when the genre itself is defined by kind of a melting pot aesthetic. There's a lot of different stuff that they're doing, but they can all be reasonably classified in the subgenre. And the last thing I want to say, because I want to use this, is kind of the lens, really. Because it's less interesting if I just, let me tell you the ways in which these are New Jack Swing, but I want to go back to something else Teddy Riley said, who defined it so elegantly as sweet melody with big beat, and then defined it less elegantly but more fun as the new kid on the block who's swinging it. And I want to keep that in mind as we go through our two subtitles albums and consider, what are they swinging? And you, Tim, may already know what one of them is swinging, yes. But we'll get to that one second. anything on New Jack Swing that I should explain more, or anything on Janet Jackson before we move forward?
I think the only thing I wanted to say about Janet Jackson is just, it's fun to see which albums that were just enormous hits Spin wants to include, and I think it is worth reiterating that this album is just an absolutely enormous, nuclear level hit. Again, not that I'm an expert in the history of the charts, but even the quickest Google tells you that this thing was absolutely huge, not just in 1989, but in succeeding years. And it's always cool to me to see which of those albums that are big, not just for people who get into music, but big for anyone who ever turned on their radio during the first Bush administration. That to me is interesting, which ones they pick. And this one, seems like as good a one like that to choose as any.
And it's important to have those. These lists can't be all ivory tower stuff. what is actually moving the people? That's important. I think offhand, it sold 12 million copies or something. nominated for 9 Grammys, I want to say. Again, the Grammys are stupid, but, like, they're a reasonable metric for popularity. You know, this is a major hit, and Janet Jackson was just freaking huge in, you know, the 80s into the 90s. I think that's another effect from the fallout of Nipplegate that, like, we forget just how big Janet Jackson was, too. That she kind of just got memory hold to some degree. Or not memory hold, but just, like, totally bound to one memory. But no, she was moving albums in 1989 and 1990 and you know, again, during the first Bush administration into Clinton. So yeah, shout out to Janet Jackson. Excited to see her here. I like this entry. It's certainly not my favorite album on here. I think, you know, we can all guess that, but it's one that I'm happy to see here. I hope hangs on. And I think it's well worth your time and investigation, if only you just want to check out musically what's happening, because, again, that's, like, it's really cool what's happening across this album. So let's start with Karen White and make Tim wait for the one I know he wants to talk about. And we'll go with her self-titled album from 1988. So I think with both of these examples, they're both in New Jack Swing, but I think they, you know, they lean more one way or the other. And this is the one that leans more heavily into R&B, and more into a pop R&B in particular. Karen White knows a ballad. She's not afraid to pull out a ballad. She's pretty good at the ballads. And that's sort of important. You'll hear ballads on the second one, but they are an afterthought, and I'll get into why they even exist. But Karen White, like, you can just hear in her voice, in the melodies, in the harmonies, like, right, this is someone with R&B training who's kind of coming up in that space. And that's sort of where this one is weighted, more than the rap aspect of it. Karen White is not going to rap. She's not going to get particularly close. But you are going to hear that in the music, especially the opening run. We open with The Way You Love Me, which has this, like, burrowing snare sound. So again, we're emphasizing that right away, that vital element of New Jack Swing. And there are, you know, synth laser shots kind of piercing through this. So early on, we're in that, right, what Rhythm Nation is doing early on, right? There's kind of that that similarity there of we're emphasizing snare, we're emphasizing the drum machine, we're emphasizing synth noise. So we're in that space already, and The Way You Love Me is kind of a cluttered thing, but not in a bad way. Like, there's just a lot of interesting elements that sort of flow into one another. There's a lot of fluttering and buzzing behind, again, that just that very driving beat that starts us out. What glues it all together is Karen White's voice. And I think that's what glues the whole album together. And I think what I want to, not I think, I know what I want to look at here in particular is, so if we, again, if we use the lens of a new kid on the block who's swinging it, what are they swinging? I think Karen White is swinging Karen White herself. We talked, yeah, follow me here. We talked a while back, our episode on self-titled albums, how that's significant, how it usually means an artist wants to redefine themselves or announce themselves. We have a self-titled debut here. I think Karen White is swinging, not in an egotistical way. I think that's honestly one of the beautiful aspects of this album, how, you know, she's able to mine kind of the personal and make it so empathetic, make it universal, to put it more tritely. Right, she's doing that very well, so I don't think this is a thing of egoism. I think it's, she is going through this album and defining her own experience, and to a large degree an experience of womanhood, and making that the glue of all the songs. So the music at every point is kind of following her, is working around her, is building space that her voice is creating. And I think it's really cool to hear it that way. So Secret Rendezvous, a song that Tim and I both saw the name of and thought, hey, I know that, and then listened to, and I don't know if you had the same experience, but I heard it and I went, this isn't what I was thinking of, but I still think I've heard this.
Yes.
Yeah, so so we both had the same experience with that. So maybe you hear that name and you go, wait, that sounds familiar. I think that's also indicative of kind of the experience of this album, where it's a lot of singles that were big, like big, that I think a lot of people have heard in the wild or just out and about, but like you don't necessarily remember them right away, or you can't necessarily place them, but you hear it and you're like, that's vaguely familiar. I think that's, again, that's indicative of the experience of this whole album, which is full of songs like that. But anyway, Secret Rendezvous is the second song. It keeps things up-tempo, so we're still operating in a pretty new Jack Swing space, but the music is often punctuating White's vocals, or it fills the space around her, right? Like, we get her singing and where her emphasis points are, and the music is working around that, or you'll get a snare shot or a synth shot or something that, like, she finishes a line, there's your period. So structurally, we have the music working with her voice, supplementing her voice, really. And she has kind of a swagger on this song that she doesn't on every song, but it's like she, you know, to borrow our verbiage here, like, she's swinging, and the music follows her, that she is, you know, strutting through space, that she's walking through space, that she's carving space. And it's like, you know, if you see in a show, you ever imagine, like, you know, what if I was walking around and, like, there's just a soundtrack that, like, is vaguely around me, like that sort of sonic aura that follows me around. And honestly, like, I don't, you know, I think that is a way to hear this album. Like, it does feel in certain moments like the music just follows or just surrounds White, that she is narrating her experience, that she's reflecting on, you know, gender in R&B and in rap in particular, and that the music is, again, just following and engaging with her, that it surrounds her at every point, but that it's working for her. It's this really interesting experience, I think. And there's not many albums that I think can do that, where it feels like, okay, this person is definitely at the center of this, and everything builds around them. And wherever she goes, the music is going to go. It's a really cool element of the production, I think, that it's able to feel that way. And this continues through the whole thing, even when the album kind of emotionally pulls itself down, or I guess musically pulls itself down, or like emotionally ramps itself up, I suppose. When it goes into ballads is the crisper way of saying that. But there's also, you know, extra stuff happening here. Slow Down pulls out a very twinkly, like, acoustic guitar melody. It's very pretty. And then there's like a hair metal noodling solo in the middle of the thing. So Karen White, like Janet Jackson, is pulling from different, you know, different genres, but doing so as the emotions see fit, as her whatever experience she's working through sees fit on the album. Superwoman, I think, is right the big track that carries forward from this album. I don't know if it was the biggest one at the time, but I think now it's the one that, like, has the longest legacy. And thematically, I think sort of like Rhythm Nation, like, it's not pandering, it's not polemical, it's not aggressive or anything like that. It's a very honest, earnest look at at womanhood, at misogyny, at you know, living in a domestic space as a woman and still trying to define yourself, of, you know, of agency, of self-ownership, of all these things in a very just honest, reflective way, really. It's not really building an argument so much as saying, you know, here is the experience, and this is true, and this is vital, and, you know, kind of coming to an understanding of that. So it's very elegantly done, I think, lyrically, thematically. Like, there's no cudgel there or anything. It's just, you know, here's the experience. And again, the music sort of swells and dips around this, White's, there's crispy, very snappy snares across this thing. So, right, this is more of a ballad. It's more of a pop R&B thing, but we still have that connection to New Jack Swing. And there's light, sun-drenched bass and keys across the whole thing. But White's voice is really floating and cutting through all the space as necessary. You know, when she feels happier, when there's a positive reflection, she's sort of floating through the music. When she needs to punctuate a point, she will cut right through it. You will hear her just exist in that space differently. And then the music follows suit. It will go up or down with her. You know, as we get to the back half of this album, I think we see more of the musical experimentation too. Some of the interesting stuff that it's taking on, Love Saw and Family Man and Don't Mess With Me, all have, they're all kind of like Paula Abdul before Paula Abdul, or just before Paula Abdul. Like, that's the sort of kind of music that we're in. And there's, to me, it sounds like an increase in kind of Caribbean influence. Like, I'm pretty sure there are marimbas on One Wish. But rhythmically, it becomes closer to some Caribbean stuff, I think, towards the end, which I don't necessarily have, like, an argument for, but I just think it's an interesting, like, it's interesting to hear how this album, you know, the influences it's pulling in as it goes along. It starts kind of more familiar, and then by the end, it's White kind of just pulling in more and more stuff. And I think the arc of that is fun to listen to. And it, again, it serves thematic purpose too. So when we have that on One Wish near the end, it really helps supplement White's kind of breezy hope across that track lyrically. So it's another instance of, right, the music is following her emotional, reflective, kind of philosophical state, whether she's, you know, just imagining a relationship, whether it's a song about love or wishing, maybe that more typical R&B fodder at the time, or whether she's getting more conscious, right? She's not getting into, like, aggressive street rap here by any means. But again, there is focus on larger issues. So in that way, we have maybe the spirit of, you know, hip-hop's rugged honesty and R&B's breeziness. We have those coming together in particular ways. And I think what Karen White is swinging here, so to speak, is, right, is her experience, is a certain type of experience that goes unheralded too often. And the way that this album is built and constructed, she's very much at the center of it. And I think how all of the music, the New Jack Swing roots included, work around her and with her, is really the standout piece of this album. So that's Karen White. Tim, any thoughts on that?
Well, I'm always a sucker for vocal people first, and being someone who remembers her largely from like ShopRite. I mean, the vocals, like, stand out. Like, she is a really, really talented vocal artist. And there is something to be said for, like, whatever it is that you are good at doing, if you're working within, like, a larger genre, like, adapting it to, like, suit you is the obviously the right thing to do. Like, that's obviously the right way to make the music and, like, sort of make that fit, but you find your spot in it by emphasizing yourself. I think it's a very, like, logical point of view, like, which is not a word that we use a lot for music or music production, but, like, this does seem like a very logical album.
Yeah, and it's just something that, like, surprisingly doesn't happen all that often, to the point where it is striking when I was going through this album and kind of had that realization of, like, oh, yeah, that makes perfect sense, and, like, there she is. But it's just not something that I don't think we hear it too much. So I think Karen White is a really good example of, like, what it could be, of, like, a vision of music that is logical, of how it works and how it's constructed. All right, you ready?
Yeah.
All right. Belle Biv DeVoe and their album Poison, which has has the song we all know, thank you, from 1990. That's our second choice here. Poison the Song has a very... it is... trying to word this without gushing, and I'm kind of failing, but like, it is subject to two like gags in two of my favorite shows ever, which I think speaks to the importance of the song and to the art that I intake. Where in Scrubs, Turk has a dance routine to Poison in an episode with the air band, magnificent, and in Archer, where it took me 9-10 watches before I realized in the episode about the Grand Prix that first, second, and third place, when they open the episode, and they do this very quickly, are Bell, Bivens, and DeVoe. The dudes in Bell, Biv, DeVoe. It's an incredible sign gag, basically. Up there with The Simpsons' best, I think. Tim, anything on Poison?
So where I would go with this is, when I was in college, my first year, one of the people down the hall, we would occasionally, without warning or like discussing it beforehand, would just sort of go up to one another and like put a hand on the other one's shoulder and say, "Never trust a big butt and a smile." Like, we would just sort of do that as like a greeting or a cone or something along those lines.
The only way for men to greet each other. let's talk about that part of it all. I'm giggling. I shouldn't be giggling. This is the serious part. This album is all kinds of fun and silly, and it's also one that has a lot of problems. You might hear "Never Trust a Big Butt and a Smile," or, you know, the entirety of Poison and think, "Hey, that's pretty misogynistic." It is. Or you might hear a song like "Do Me" and think, "Hey, he's very close to describing statutory rape." He is. How this thing has not been canceled, I've made my views on whether that's possible or not clear before, but how this thing hasn't been, I have no idea. Just to be honest, I think Poison is just so infectious that it resists and rides above. But this was a cause concern in 90 when it's coming out, because these dudes are not progressive, shall we say. And part of the, I suppose, lasting, unfortunately, an interesting legacy of this album is that it is kind of early in that, like, that casual misogyny and catchy music sells really damn well. And that's something that's going to continue. And Bell, Biv, DeVoe I'm not making it like misogyny was not in music before that, but kind of the way that it is welded into these pop genres, and just sort of an assumed part of it. Like, Bell, Biv, DeVoe is kind of out front of that, for worse. So I don't want to make it seem like this album is all, you know, breezy fun times. You may listen to it and just think, "Nope, I'm out. These dudes are cruel and crude and whatever else." Fair, they are. But it is New Jack Swing, and we're going to look at it that way. And I think it is important musically. And I think if Karen White leans more into the R&B side of things, Poison leans more into the hip-hop side of things. But it also leans into the, like, boy band soul side of things, because these are three of the dudes who are in New Edition, and Bell, Biv, DeVoe was basically a side project, while I think two of the other dudes were doing some solo stuff. So you have Bell, you have Bivens, and you have DeVoe, who are more interested in doing hip-hop than they were of doing more New Edition, and this was kind of the outlet for them to do that, because they weren't going to be able to in their bigger band. So it's I mean, a way of thinking of it is three dudes from New Edition with a different balance of things, who are taking New Jack Swing and swinging it in the way of hip-hop, which is something they'd been wanting to do, and here was their outlet to do it, and here is an outlet that got really, really popular, that made them really, really famous, such that there was a New Edition reunion not long after this album came out, and I think this was really a, like, touchy point of tension between the band, because Belle Biv DeVoe got really big, and that kind of overshadowed whatever New Edition was up to at some points. You can hear it early on, how we have those, like, soul and doo-wop harmonies, and that's part of what makes this so interesting, but it's just harder. On Let Me Know Something, there's a much harder backbeat. There's a much funkier bass. It's much deeper in the rhythms. Stuff is tuned down lower. Like, there's, right, there's just more low end. There's more rhythm. There's more rumble. There's a harder edge to all of it. It smooths out the snare aggressiveness a little bit, but you still get those very piercing, halting strikes. And beats, the syncopation, you get all that here. It's very much working in that New Jack mode. But it's, you know, especially compared to what they're doing in New Edition, or what, right, those soul and R&B bands of the late 80s are doing. It's just much harder. It's much funkier. It's much more influenced by the aesthetics of hip-hop, but not necessarily the lyricism. So, interesting wrinkle here where Karen White is, you know, moving musically away from the hip-hop side of things, but lyrically towards it, thematically towards it. Belle Biv DeVoe is moving musically towards it and thematically away. What they're swinging here is a new balance of music. They're also swinging their dicks. I know. I was building to a point, Tim.
I'm gonna be mad.
What?
I was just like, oh, it's, it was just, I was so prepared for a dick swinging thing that when you started talking about anything that wasn't that, I was just like, this feels like a technicality answer. It's like those people who say, like, that John Hanson guy was the first president of the United States.
Look, man, I'm building 2 points simultaneously, and one of them may be more convincing, so I was going to save it for the end, which is what good rhetoricians do. Mm-hmm. This is a dick-swinging album. These guys are horny. They are swinging their sexuality across this whole thing. And your mileage may vary on that. Very likely you don't have a lot of mileage for it, but in 1990, to hear three guys who are understood as, right, you're part of an institution like New Edition, be so aggressively sexual, that's a big thing. To hear hip-hop that is so aggressively sexual, that's a big thing. This is stuff that is going to become commonplace. So again, I think it's kind of hard to hear, like, right, you may have fun with this album, but it's kind of hard to hear it as, like, transgressive in some way. But it's really out ahead of some trends, for better and worse. For the better, on the side of the music, I think. The way it is melding. The Bomb Squad actually comes in and does some production with this album on a few songs. So, like, it has those very clear ties to hip-hop. And it has some of that edge. It has some of that hardness. It has some of that funk that is really in vogue in rap production at the time. So it's very much grounded in that. And it's Bivens in particular who wants to, right, he raps on some New Edition songs and, like, who really wants space to just kind of cook here. And he gets it, for most of the album anyway. So we have them just really experimenting with, like, this genre that is interesting to them, is important to them, and kind of flexing their muscle with it, flexing the muscle of what's possible with it if you put it into a, you know, a more an R&B space, a soul space, a kind of disco space that they're also familiar with. So I think Poison is just a really important album for New Jack Swing and understanding the hip hop side of it. And of hearing what a lot of stuff going forward is going to be. Right, a lot of Bad Boys productions are going to come out of this. You know, harder rhythms, lighter melodies, you know, sweet melodies and big beat again. And, you know, certainly not all of the Bad Boys productions, but a lot of them are thematically, lyrically less intense, we'll go with, are just less socially concerned, usually, are hornier in general, are a lot more sexual. I think you're going to hear a lot of music go this way, where this blend just becomes understood. So again, Poison is as that kind of the vanguard of that, both in cool ways musically and both in bad and in bad ways, in terms of the misogyny in particular, the casualness of it. I mean, I could talk about a lot of songs here. Let's just talk about Poison itself. It interpolates Kool G Rap, who is the dude yelling Poison. It's like 30 some times. Our favorite guy. Some of the lyrics are interpolated from KRS-One. Some of the melodies interpolated from LL Cool J. So it's not like these guys are posers, so to speak. Like, they are familiar with the history in which they are working, and they're actively pulling from that to detrimental effect sometimes. Like, I think they stole some lyrics from, like, 15-year-old Busta Rhymes on one song. I forget which one it is, but I think they, like, just straight up jacked some of his lyrics. But all that to say, like, again, they are familiar. Again, the Bomb Squad's coming in here. Like, they're familiar with the milieu in which they are working, and they're actively moving this thing that they're already famous for in a different direction. And in a direction that the 90s is just going to take up and take forward, to a very large degree. And I suppose the last thing I'll say, Chuck D, very critical. I don't think anyone's surprised, because he's critical of, I think, New Jack Swing in general, you know, saying that, look, rap and R&B are just up to different things. Like, our music is trying to be politically, socially engaged. It's trying to be real. It's not trying to coddle. You know, we're saying things, we're showing things as we see them. And R&B at that point is very light, very airy, very breezy, maybe lightly romantic or sexualized, so not explicitly. Like, there's just not much there. It's for dancing. And I think in all three of these albums, again, we're seeing, like, the condensing of that space. I think Poison as an album is both a reaction to Chuck D in a positive sense, and that, no, these things can exist. Watch them bring us together. And ironically, kind of proves him right, that, like, they don't really get more of a message when they bring them together. Like, they just pull in the aesthetics and just become much more aggressively sexual. That there's still not really a message here. But musically, more than Karen White, more than Janet Jackson, probably, like, this is the blend that's going to carry forward for a long time. So when I led with they're swinging a new blend of music, I think they are, right? They're doing it this way. But, you know, across the album, if you just listen to it, they're dick swinging. And that's something that's going to carry forward too. So Poison, as fun and delightful as the song itself is, the album, sneakily influential. Again, I think for better and for worse. And I think I'll rest there, before I get too excited, I suppose, about the album. Any thoughts on Belle Biv DeVoe or on Poison?
So I have one serious-ish thought and one not very serious thought, but I'm just sort of looking at the track list for Poison, and in the first 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 tracks on this album, there are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 different, no, it's more than that. I think they have 6 punctuation marks for 5 psalms, which is, like, really kind of an indicative statement about the level of excitement and, like, emotional availability that's in these. That was not my serious-ish point. I just think it's very funny that they just really love questions and they really love exclamation points.
Look, they're an emotionally... They're not stunted. They're swinging big here, and they pull in more exclamation points than I've seen in any album besides, like, an Art Brut thing.
The other thing that sort of stood out to me is the second song in the album, BBD, I Thought It Was Me, is interesting because I feel like in 1990, you listen to that song and you think it's, like, just about a girl who wants to sleep with everybody, like, oh, what a slut she must be, etc. And, like, you listen to it now, and I'm sure this is not intentional, but mostly it just makes me think, wow, none of these guys are that good at sex. Like, that's mostly the impression I get from that, is, like, it feels like a sore loser kind of song, which makes me like them more. Like, if I thought the whole thing was just sort of irretrievably about bedding as many women as possible, I think that would be sort of less enjoyable. But, like, there is an interpretation of that one where, like, I Thought It Was Me is a sign that you're however old they are at this moment and think that you are the lord of coxmanship when, in fact, you are just, like, just a dude who's slanging it.
I think you're right. I think they also do think they are lords of cockmanship.
Yes, but exactly.
Like, yeah, now especially, it's like, oh, you're just sad sacks. All right, I think in part that speaks to a toxic masculinity. I put that in air quotes, but, like, no, it just does. But I think you're right that, like, it's almost kind of quaint at this point how obvious it is here. And, like, that makes it go down a little bit easier, perhaps. But, you know, I think across the thing, they still totally think they are.
Yes.
You know, their dick is all that and a bag of chips. But it is interesting to just listen to this album as a series of failures, which is basically what it is. And then deferring the blame onto the woman, that's the problem. Right? That's what Poison is doing, mm-hmm. as enjoyable as it is. But, yeah, again, you hear that and you may go, well, a lot of music does that right now. Yeah, that's sort of my point. they're swinging themselves and they're swinging a new kind of subgenre into the future. I should add too, before we move on, you'll go through the first 6 songs of this album and have a really different experience than the last, I'm sorry, the first 7 and have a really different experience than the last 2. And the last 2, to the best of my understanding, it was basically one of those situations where the label's like, no, you need a single, and then artists passive-aggressively put one on there. And this was a situation of, like, we can't sell this thing. You need something that feels more like New Edition. And so we get When Will I See You Smile Again and I Do Need You, which are more soul-focused, really go in on the harmonies. The rapping is, if there at all, much less emphasized. It's just softer R&B stuff. I think it's largely a label concession. There's a saxophone solo in one of them. Like, they're a totally different vibe than the first 7. And as far as I can tell, I think that was like, either you put these on here or there's no album. So I think that's what's happening there. If you're listening to this and you have the sensation of, like, what the hell happened here? Where did that horny guy go? I think that's what's happening. anything else on these, Tim? You ready for spiel?
Yeah, let's spiel it up.
All right, so our entry today, number 50-something on the spin list, I don't remember offhand, 54. 54 on the spin list is Janet Jackson's Rhythm Nation 1814. her 1989 album, that again is musically and technically and in terms of production still kind of a marvel. It's just, you know, it's really cool what's happening across that thing, and sneakily very influential. It's harder to hear now. It is one of those albums. But if you just kind of try and transport yourself back to the space of 89, the fusion, the blending that's happening on this album is really profound for that moment. Jackson is up to some really just really big and interesting stuff. And of course, this is an album based in New Jack Swing. That's bringing on a ton of other genres as well. That's you know, for a subgenre that's based in fusing, Jackson's fusing even more into it. But we talked about the ways in which that album is, right, again, the foundation of it is a New Jack Swing. And so that's our theme for today, considering that little movement in music, and considering it along the lines of how Teddy Riley describes it in different places as sweet melodies and big beats. Again, this new fusion of hip-hop and R&B, aesthetically and thematically. And then also this idea of a new kid on the block who's swinging it. And I wanted to look at two big New Jack Swing albums in those terms. So first is Karen White's self-titled debut in 1988, where she's leaning more heavily into the pop, into the R&B side of things. She has a very lovely voice and is not afraid of a ballad. So we're going to hear that stuff emphasized across this album. Though again, it opens immediately with the very distinct snare sound of New Jack Swing, and the very distinct synth and kind of digital noise that is important to New Jack Swing. So we're opening that space, and then Karen White is kind of guiding us into different places. And as I was arguing, I think what's extra interesting about this album is how everything builds around or punctuates or supplements her voice in some way. It's as if the music is following her, as if she has this aura around her, and whatever experience she's having or sharing, whatever reflection she's having, whatever emotion she's feeling at any point lyrically, the music is following suit. It is supplementing that. It is punctuating that. This is true of the more up-tempo songs, stuff like The Way You Love Me or Secret Rendezvous, and it's true of the slower stuff, of the more emotionally wrought, of the more ballady stuff, songs like Superwoman or Slow Down to some degree, and it's true towards the end of the album where White kind of moves back to a more explicit New Jack Swing space, even kind of presaging Paula Abdul very slightly, or when she's bringing in kind of breezier Caribbean stuff at the very end. This is an album of Karen White being conscious of her experiences, of her feelings, and of her experiences and feelings as a woman, and as a woman in these particular genres, and as a woman in domestic spaces. And right, those gender politics, shall we say, in general. It's very earnest throughout. Again, it's not polemical. It's not really making an argument. It's just sharing honest reflection and sense of self and kind of establishing an agency lyrically, and that the music swells and builds around her, I think is a perfect encapsulation of that mode as well. That she's taking New Jack Swing into a poppier, into the more R&B side of things. The hip-hop bass is here, but it's here particularly in terms of her consciousness, in terms of her lyrical focus across the album. So that's how she's kind of bringing these things together in this late 80s moment. And second option, Belle Biv DeVoe, their 1990 album Poison, which leans much more heavily into that hip-hop side of things, but musically. Lyrically, thematically, not so much. So whereas Karen White is bringing in that consciousness, Belle Biv DeVoe is only conscious of their dicks and only conscious of their various travails romantically, not even romantically, just sexually, as we said, often ends in failure. But whether they realize that or not, it's one of the lasting problems of this album. But this is music that, right, it comes out of their New Edition roots. It is based in New Jack Swing, but it's definitely very influenced by and in conversation with hip hop. It's interpolating a lot of different artists and songs. And these are guys who know the history, who know the sonics, and are building on that very explicitly and very, very well. The music that they're designing here, that they're making, is something that's going to carry forward through the 90s into the 2000s. It sounds very just commonplace now. But in 1990, this is a big thing, a big thing to the point that the label wants them to put two more soul tracks at the end of this to really get it through, because the preceding seven are this new blend and this new aggressively sexual blend that is met with a lot of concern. But again, thematically and musically, this album is just going to become commonplace, really. So Bell Biv DeVoe is using New Jack Swing to explore new spaces that they aren't able to in their other band, New Edition, and to swing around their sense of how two genres that in 1990 are still not in much conversation, how they can put those together, how they can take these R&B and soul roots and make them more hip-hop, how they can tie these experiences together. So how they can swing a new genre into the fore, but without any of the consciousness, with only a, you know, aggressively horny stances across the whole thing, which also, again, is going to go forward and be part of the sneaky legacy of this album. So, Tim, Karen White or Bell Biv DeVoe?
This is closer than I thought it would be, even at the midway point of this episode. Like, I do think that there's an interesting case to be made for both, but I'm trying to return to your idea of the new kid on the block. Not even so much the slinging it part, because I think you have made the case pretty well that there is a great deal of slinging going on in both albums. But the thing that just feels newer, it's almost like a throwaway detail about how Bell Biv DeVoe needed something else that felt older. Because I think both of these albums have the sweet beats and the melodies that go with it. I mean, that is one of the reasons why Poison the Song is so attractive to me, is because there's like a genuinely like really nice vocal interplay going on, and we've talked about Karen White and what a great singer she is. But yeah, I'm gonna go with Poison because it is newer, because there is something about it that is a little bit harder to place, and which sort of created a level of hostility, it sounds like, whether you're Chuck D or you're a record producer. Somebody like just creating this sort of bristling effect of, I've not really dealt with this before and I'm not sure I like it. Especially because there is nothing all that ingratiating or even all that like personally pleasant about Bell Biv DeVoe as they are presenting themselves on the album.
I think that's very good reasoning. And yeah, I like that. Like, you took kind of the new kid part of that. Although when you first said that, I was thinking the band New Kids on the Block. I was like, I didn't talk about them. they're later. Yeah, no, that makes sense. I like that. You know, Poison is a track that I've heard thousands of times. Not literally, but it feels like it. And, like, that's going to be the one of anything on this episode that, like, I return to in the future that I will just hear. I think it's the most popular of anything here. That said, none of these albums are ones that I have, like, deep personal affections for. But I think they're all good. They're all interesting in their own ways. And that's a long way of saying that, like, in the way that I'm happy that Janet Jackson is just kind of here, I like talking about these two. I was happy to give them some shine and to think about New Jack Swing, which I feel like is a term that has a reasonable saturation, but is probably not, like, really understood anymore. I don't think it really has to be. I don't think there's people, you know, really engaging with New Jack Swing explicitly. I think it's just part of like the musical ether at this point. Which is also part of what I wanted to do with this episode, that like these are three albums we may not think about as like highly influential, but I think all of them are. So, you know, I was glad to get to talk about them. I'm always happy when Belle Biv DeVoe shows up in my artistic output, as I made clear at the beginning. So kudos to them for swinging it into the subtitles albums list. Anything else about these, Tim?
No, fun episode. Good explainer. Let the kids at home know about New Jack Swing, especially because it's sort of bygone at this point.
Yeah, I think it's definitely, it was a late 80s, early 90s thing. And again, I think, you know, there's stuff that's definitely carried forward, but we don't really think about it as like New Jack Swing anymore. So
it's the grammar.
I like the little explainer episodes. They're nice to do every so often. But yeah, thank you for listening. Today's entry on the spin list, number 54 overall, was Janet Jackson's Rhythm Nation 1814, her 1989 smash hit. I should keep emphasizing that because I don't think I did enough early on. Major album, major moment, major output from an artist that got unduly shafted in the early 2000s, but that I'm glad to be able to remember a bit here. And working in New Jack Swing. So that was our theme for today, just kind of unspooling what that is, what it does. And I gave Tim the choices between Karen White's self-titled debut and Belle Biv DeVoe's Poison. And Belle Biv DeVoe makes it through to the subtitles albums list. So thank you again for listening. If you want to read more about us, about who we are, what we do, the genesis behind this whole project, if you want to check out our blogs, or if you want to see Tim reviewing movies and me creating playlists, or if you want to check out all of our back episodes, of which there are many, and we are at the point now where we can reference several of them in any one episode, so maybe we gave you some jumping off points earlier on, please do check out our website, subtitlespodcast.com, and please also stay tuned for part two of this episode, where Tim is going to be talking at least in part about a guy who had a lot of different political affiliations and is really important in a specific discipline and an award, and we might say he had a new Joe Swing.
Whoa.